This is part three of the podcast for Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. Theories of Knowledge. Okay, let's talk some more about Locke. So, tabula rasa, maybe you've heard this. Come to order, please. Tabula rasa. So this means a blank slate. It's a Latin phrase. You may have heard this before in one of your other classes, maybe psychology class, where they talk about this idea that the mind is a blank slate before it's written on by experience. And so Locke says, look, before you have any experiences, your mind is essentially empty, and then as you gain more experiences, your mind organizes them into the concepts. But the organization is just sort of like, you know, mixing and matching things, putting them together. The real work is done by the experience itself. It provides the content for your brain to organize. Without experience, there's no content to your mind. So you need these experiences to learn things. So that's the big difference. And he would say the same thing about this whole idea of an innate sense of right and wrong. He would say, look, what happens is you're punished when you do certain things, and you're aware when you do other things. Physical, corporal punishment maybe, or maybe just like a frown or a look of disapproval or praise and being patted on the head. So the way you learn certain things are right and wrong is through being blamed and punished or being rewarded and praised. It's not the idea that you have some innate sense of right and wrong that tells you what you should do as you come out of the womb. It's not, you know, like there's a story of like Lao Tzu, who's the founder of Taoism, probably mythological, maybe based in some historical fact. And the story is that Lao Tzu means old baby. And the idea that his mother had like a pregnancy of like, I can't remember how long it was, like 60 or 70 years or something like that. And then Lao Tzu is born as like an old baby, right? He's like, comes out of the womb with like a long beard and, you know, fully grown, and he starts spouting off like philosophical truths of Taoism, like right out of the womb, right? But that doesn't happen. Like babies don't know anything, and they have to learn through experience. There's no innate stuff in there, and so he also, so his arguments against innate ideas is like, you know, not everybody has them, and he talks about, you know, in non-politically correct way, talks about the Indians and talk about like East Indians. Not American Indians. I guess it's archaic now. But anyway, he talks about the Indians. Indians he's using as a sort of stand-in for people that lack formal education, right? So at the time, it's, you know, I can't remember if it's, I think this is even before like the big colonialism in India. So Locke's writing in the 17th century. I guess you had the East India Company going, so some colonialism. The British Empire was kind of in its infancy, I guess, then. Anyway, but he's just talking about, okay, a person who's uneducated from like a undeveloped culture, they're not going to know all this, you know, fancy philosophy stuff or truths of logic and mathematics. Same thing with a small child, same thing with a person with a mental disability. So what about these innate ideas? If they're innate, then everybody should have them, but here are some groups of people that don't have them. So no innate ideas, not had. Darn, I keep on grabbing the wrong one. Not had by, oops, not had by an educated children, mentally challenged, or whatever the politically correct term is now. This is he uses the word idiots. So he's not talking about like, you know, somebody like at work you might call an idiot, but in the old sense, an idiot, like the village idiot, was some you know, mentally handicapped guy that they dressed up in a costume and made fun of a bit, because that's like, well, what are you going to do with a guy that can't do anything else? Well, you can dress him in a funny costume and it makes people happy by saying stupid stuff or something.
You know, the old, like, so people just call it cretins.
Yeah.
And that comes from, like, people were mentally handicapped because they had a lack of, like, creatine iodine in their diet. So it caused mental retardation in people. And so those slang came from the creatine, your creatine comes from.
Now, my thought that came from, like, people from from Crete, from the Isle of Crete.
From Crete, because they were mentally retarded because they had the lack of iodine.
Oh, huh, interesting.
So that's what caused the...
Yeah, so basically, every person should have one, and they don't have these so-called innate ideas. They don't, and so Locke says so much the worse for innate ideas. We need to get rid of this idea. He also has this kind of funny argument. He says it's politically dangerous. Like, and I think he's thinking of things like, you know, he had basically seen some autocrat. He could make some ludicrous claim, and you challenge it. He says, well, it's an innate idea. Everybody knows that this is true. And you know, I it's hard for me to think about. I mean, people do use this obvious fallacy, but it's hard for me to think about like some demagogue like pulling out the concept of innate ideas to try to justify some demagogic power, like, you know, President Trump, right, saying, we need to build the wall because it's an innate idea. That doesn't really make any sense. But Locke does think it's pernicious because it cuts off debate. As soon as you say, well, that's an innate idea, everybody knows that, you don't have to give empirical evidence anymore. So maybe there's something to it. It just strikes me as funny that Locke sees this as a politically dangerous idea. And maybe he's thinking about something like the divine right of kings, you know, this sort of idea that kings are given their power by God, and that might be peddled as an innate idea. So it's hard to say. Anyway, what else about Locke? We should talk about his classification of ideas. Descartes, kind of the intellectual heir of Plato. Locke is the philosophical heir of Aristotle. And we didn't get a chance to talk a lot about Aristotle, but he's an empiricist. And, like, you know, Plato has this idea of, like, concepts are real, and, like, this sort of idea of the form of man. Like, Plato would say there's the form of man which is responsible for, like, all the individual men. Mo and Larry and Curly, right? And he would say, Mo, Larry, and Curly, like actual physical men, participate in the concept of man. And he thinks about concepts as being real things. Aristotle says that's foolish. Man is just an abstraction that we get when we look at the individual men. And so he would say, maybe think about this, the arrow going down. Oops, Larry. Curly. So Aristotle said that's not the way it is. It's like you get Mo, Larry, and Curly, and you see they all have like certain traits in common. They have a certain shape. Their bodies look similar. They have similar like organs and systems. And so you think you form the concept of man, you know, based on it's a abstraction. It's an abstract concept. It's something that we create. It's not, the qualities are out there in nature, but it's our minds that put them together. So man, the concept of man doesn't have any existence outside our minds. It's an abstraction. And we look out using our senses, and we know certain things have certain things in common. We kind of group them together, and we come up with like theories. This is why Aristotle's theory of classification of biological organisms is something we still use today, you know, with some modifications. But the idea of phylum and genus and differentiation, all are the basis for biological classification goes back to Aristotle. And it's all based on like noticing like, okay, what's the same about these two things? What's different about these two things? And putting things into categories. That's something we do based on our senses. It's not a priori. It's not a series of deduction. It's an induction. And so the inductive method is sort of induction versus deduction. Locke is also like a representationalist. I think so. Descartes is too. So what's representationalism? The idea is that the concept of representationalism is we have certain ideas in our mind that represent reality to our consciousness. So we have a concept of say a cat, and then out there in the world there's representations of the idea of a cat. And so we have an idea of a cat in our mind, and that represents the cat there in the external world. And our belief is true if the mental cat represents the physical cat, say. So Locke thinks, where do all ideas come from? Well, he thinks there's different kinds of ideas represent different physical manifestations. So one sort of puzzle about this sort of representationalist idea, first of all, how do we know it's true? Why don't we say you're seeing the actual cat? I'm looking at a cat, there's the cat. Am I seeing the real cat, or am I seeing something else? Cat versus, just contrast this with direct realism. So the representationalism says that your senses are they mediate between you and the material object. Direct realism says when you look at the cat, you're seeing the real cat. When you look at the table, you're seeing the real table. So when you're a direct realist, the skeptical problem sort of evaporates. You say, there's this guy, I mentioned G.E. Moore. He's asked, how do you prove the existence of the material world? And he said, here I'm going to give you a philosophical proof that exists at least two things exist in the world. You ready? Okay, here's a hand. Two objects in the material world. Problem done. Right? And he sort of dismisses this skeptical problem. Whereas Descartes is going to start out with first-person consciousness, what am I aware of? What's in my conscious mind? Then try to get to external reality. And Locke's doing the same thing, although Locke doesn't really ask the skeptical questions the way Descartes does. But Locke's interested in finding out, how are we aware of reality? And he'd say it's always mediated to the senses. Our beliefs in the world, our concepts or our representations in our mind come from what's called sense data. And we get this kind of fragmentary clues from indirect awareness of the external world from our senses. So if you're looking at you're looking at a cat. Let's draw over here. My representation of the cat. So you're looking at the cat, and so first of all, light waves are bouncing off the cat, and so so you're looking with your eye maybe, and so you have some light source, maybe it's the sun, the cat's outside, light waves bouncing into your eyes. And then maybe you have an ear, right? You might hear the cat and might meow. So you hear this in your ear. That's the sound waves go into your ear and it converts into the sensation of hearing. Maybe you pet the cat and you feel its soft fur, right? So it's the sensation of touch. And all these things, your mind puts together as the idea of the cat, an object out there in the real world. So Locke tries to break this down. He says, what's really going on here? How do we get how does our consciousness of the cat come to be? How does our experience kind of work? And he says, there's simple ideas and there's complex ideas. And then there's primary qualities and secondary qualities. So these two distinctions are really important. First, you have simple ideas. Simple ideas. And these are ideas of qualities. And you have complex ideas. And these are ideas of substances or things. And they're combinations of simple ideas. Ideas, I guess. Okay, simple idea. So a simple idea would be like the idea of greenness or of furriness or something, of softness, right, if you pet the cat. And then a complex idea would be like the idea of the cat itself, which is made up of furriness and softness and maybe the cat's shape and the cat's color and all those things put together. So the simple ideas are represented by qualities, which are the way in which a thing exists, and then complex ideas represent the thing itself, which is just a combination of all of these simple ideas. So the way our mind puts together our sensations, like the sounds and the touch and the maybe if there's a smell, right? All those things get put together, our visual sensations, they get to put together in our mind, even though they're coming from separate sensations, and we form the concept of an object like the cat. Now, simple ideas are always based on qualities, and the qualities come in two kinds. Let's see. So put this qualities. Primary and the secondary. So, and this is a pretty important distinction. A primary quality is a quality an object really has. It doesn't depend on human beings. It's an objective quality that is there whether or not a human being has ever perceived it. And like a classic example of a primary quality would be something like shape. Like an object has a certain shape. You know, the earth has always been round. It's never been flat. And even if no human life ever existed on planet Earth, the earth would still be round. Locke would say that's different than secondary qualities. Secondary qualities are the way primary qualities affect human beings. So like color is a prime example of a secondary quality. And Locke says that colors don't really exist in the real world because colors require certain kinds of perceptual equipment. So we have cones and rods in our eyes. The rods allow us to see in dim light and see in black and white. And the colors, the cones, allow us to see color. And so what happens is there's like an objective wavelength of light that goes into our eyes at a certain, you know, wavelength, so many angstroms between the peaks and the troughs, and that's the red wavelength. But the sensation of redness, that's something that comes from us. And so without us having cones and the color receptors in our eyes, we wouldn't have that red sensation. So Locke would say that redness is it's the ability of objects to create red sensations in us through their primary qualities. So what qualities would that be? Well, it'd be sort of like surface structure or shape, right? So the reason that we see an object as red is because it's got some molecular surface structure, or say purple, like my shirt. So why do we see this as purple? Well, it's reflecting, it's absorbing all the wavelengths of light except for the purple wavelength, and that one is bouncing into your eyes, and then your color receptors are converting that into a purple sensation, right? So he would say this, my shirt isn't really purple, but it is really, and it's not really soft either because that's like a tactile sensation, but he'd say it is, you know, say made out of cotton, and it does have a certain molecular structure that would create those sensations of softness and color, purpleness. Yeah.
What if, so say in this scenario, so if everyone inside this classroom was colorblind, and so they're limited to a certain spectrum of colors, and so the colors are mostly different from what they perceive them to actually be. So your shirt that you're wearing right now would actually be probably